I see two members of the MSU men's basketball team are transferring here. This according to Joe Rexroad, occasional current state contributor from the Detroit Free Press. Sophomore forwards Marvin Clark and Javon Bess will finish their 2 years of eligibility elsewhere. One was Clark is something of a surprise because he was seeing more playing time than Bess, according to Joe Rexroad's account. So, but we do at the same time have apparently Tom Izzo's most heralded class of recruits coming to East Lansing here later in the year. And so Bass, I guess, was less of a surprise because he was destined to see not a whole lot of playing time still, according to Mr. Rexroad. Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. We are glad you're along for our Tuesday show. At the top of our program, January 3rd, 1961, was a cold day in the history of the Cold War. Dwight Eisenhower's presidency was fast fading into memory. On that day, the United States formally broke off all diplomatic ties with Cuba. Just 213 days and one botched military coup attempt later, the man who would one day reconnect America with Cuba was born. Last week, President Obama became the first U.S. president to visit Cuba in nearly 90 years. It is a new day between the United States and Cuba. Joining us to talk about the changing social climate in Cuba is Donna Rich Kaplowitz. She's an assistant professor in the Residential College of Arts and Humanities at Michigan State University and an expert on Cuba. Also joining us, Tim Geisner, an MSU freshman who traveled to Cuba in January and is writing a paper about his experience. Donna, Tim, welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
We'll talk more about President Obama's visit to Cuba here a little bit later in the segment, but I do want to get your first impressions. Donna, first of all, what was it like for you to watch the news last week and see a U.S. president visiting Cuba?
I'll tell you, it was absolutely thrilling. I've been working on Cuba for over 30 years, and for a long time, we thought we would never see this day. And so I literally sat at my TV and tears streamed down my face.
You've got less history with it, Tim, but what'd you make of it?
I mean, I don't have nearly the experience Donna does.
Of course.
Seeing Obama stand in front of the cathedral that I was standing in just months before was a pretty powerful moment.
Mm. When did you first become intrigued with Cuba, Donna, and what was it that appealed to you about
it? Yeah, so I was probably just about Tim's age back in the 80s, and I had an opportunity to visit Cuba that was pretty unprecedented at the time. There were no American tourists. There were no travelers between our two countries, but I was a fully hosted guest of a Cuban Baptist church, and I got to see really authentic Cuba. I stayed in Cuban homes and spoke in Cuban churches, and I was enamored with the island. I felt as though, after having traveled significantly in other third world countries, the Cuban model had something to teach us. They were taking care of their people in a way that I hadn't seen in other third world countries.
Tim, how recently were you there?
We were there in December to January, so about 10, 11 days.
Just a few months ago, then?
Just a few months ago.
Okay. Cuba had strong ties for many years, key ties to the Soviet Union. What did you see happening in Cuba, Donna, after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 91?
Right. So just to go back to the 80s, when the Soviets were very heavily involved and supportive of the Cuban economy, things in Cuba were booming, and people had access to material goods. They had food, obviously, excellent medical care. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Cuban economy shrank by 34% overnight. It was significant. My friends who had never known hunger had to look for food. Mm. People who had cars couldn't get gasoline. There were blackouts in Havana for 8 hours a day. It was very, very difficult period of time for Cubans. They call it the special period in time of peace, a euphemism for...
Special period in a time of peace?
That's what Fidel called it, yes, after the Soviet Union collapsed. Instead of saying, we're really screwed, he said, we are going through a special period right now.
Yeah. Well, we all saw, again, the news coverage of President Obama's visit to Cuba last week. But fast forward for us, Donna, what has happened more recently that to enable President Obama to reach that point?
Right. So there have been a number of things that have happened during his presidency. First of all, Obama came in having won the state of Florida both in 2008 and 2012. This is significant because Florida is home to many, many Cuban Americans, the majority of Cuban Americans, who traditionally were opposed to normalization of relations between the two countries. That changed over time when younger Cubans, Cubans who are now in their middle age, no longer had the same ideological opposition. And so he felt more enabled by domestic U.S. politics to entertain the ideas of opening relations. Moreover, there was pressure from the international community. Whereas once upon a time, the United States was a leader in embargoing Cuba and other countries towed the U.S. line. In the last 10 years, that hasn't been the case. Countries from all over the world trade with Cuba, have diplomatic relations with Cuba, and began exerting significant pressure on the United States government to change our policy. In fact, at the United Nations, there's a vote every year about the U.S. embargo against Cuba. And in the last few years, the vote has been 188 countries against the embargo, two countries in favor of the embargo. So there was international pressure, domestic pressure, and certainly U.S. business interests that were chomping at the bit to get into Cuba. And as they watched our foreign trade partners divide up the island.
Who's the other country that always voted no besides us?
Israel. And ironically, and Israel voted with us, although they had trade relations with Cuba. So it was a political move, but not an economic one.
We're talking about new relations between the United States and Cuba. Donna Rich Kaplowitz is an expert on Cuba, assistant professor in the Residential College in the Arts and Humanities at Michigan State. Also with us today, Tim Geisner, an MSU freshman in the James Madison College here at MSU, who's spent some weeks in Cuba not too long ago. What impressions, Tim, did you have of Cuba before your visit, and how did that contrast? How may that have changed after your visit?
That's a good question because so my father was in the Navy during the Cold War. He was on a nuclear-powered submarine. So I have my own, you know, biases coming in. And basically what he told me the first time I said, I want to go to Cuba, he was like, I don't know about that, Tim. I don't know about that. But after some convincing, he said he'd be all right with it. But I think I am in a unique position because of my mom being very, very liberal and letting me explore my own ideas, but my dad being very conservative on defense issues. I've had a kind of, I guess, unique mix of
Well, again, Donna, we're seeing kind of a generational change here. We've got people who were immersed in tension, political tension over Cuba, who have now are kind of aging out of the population. We've got more folks like Tim who don't look at it through that lens. That's central here?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the Cold War was over before Tim was born. And so what he saw in Cuba was pretty authentic Cuba. And I think you're going to hear that he was maybe pleasantly surprised by his experience.
Absolutely.
Tim, Cuba has what's been described as the tightest governmental control of the internet of any country in the world. And this is a topic apparently you are studying.
Indeed.
What are you learning?
So the Cuban internet system is something just so incredibly complex. It's the focus of my research paper and presentation. And so one, you have to distinguish between the intranet, which is the inner kind of internet that's only available for Cubans to connect with Cubans, so email within the island and state databases, basically. And then there's the internet that everybody else knows and loves, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter. And the penetration rates for the actual internet is quite low, considering Cuba is among the top in Latin America for healthcare and for education, while their communications are abysmal with regards to cell phones and internet. So it's just really fascinating to not only read the articles from Western, you know, publications, but go on the ground in Cuba, in Havana, at these hotspots where people go on to communicate with family in Miami, talk to them. What do they think about the internet?
Mm-hmm.
What do they think of the direction it's heading? And what do they want? And it's just been an incredible experience. I was up till 2 a.m. just researching and writing this paper. And it's just been a really rewarding experience, but kind of a never-ending experience as well.
Well, let's focus in on social media, too. Where is social media in Cuba right now compared to our general experience right. in this country?
So everybody, I say everybody, almost everybody on these hotspots are on Facebook, talking with friends and family, right? So whenever I interviewed people at these hotspots, the first thing they always say is Facebook with friends in Miami, Facebook with family in Miami. This is what they use it for. The other thing is video calling. They want to talk to their family, and the internet has been able to give them that. Although it should be noted that in order to access the internet, you have to pay about two kooks or $2 an hour, whereas the monthly salary for a Cuban is the average is about $20. So,
fascinating evolution here. How does, Donna, how does social media sync up with what the party wants the Cuban people to know and to understand? What kind of tension are we seeing there? Assuming we're seeing some tension.
Well, you know, I would say that to everybody's surprise who's been watching Cuba for a long time, when Raul Castro came to power in 2008, he really did some significant changes. And some of that, a lot of that was economic. So he allowed for private businesses to open. Now, 20 to 25% of the Cuban population is privately employed, which was absolutely unheard of prior to 2006. And he also did some political opening. And this included some access to the internet. I'm able to communicate with my friends in Cuba via email, no problem, and that's been true for a number of years. My kids are connected with their Cuban friends on Facebook. And so the government has opened up possibilities, whereas 10, 15 years ago, that wasn't possible.
I've got to ask one question here involving Fidel, because Fidel Castro, just in the last 24 hours or so, denounced President Obama's visit, saying, I'll quote here, "We don't need the empire to give us anything." Pretty harsh in the larger context of how President Obama's visit was viewed by, I think, a lot of people. What do you take from that?
Yeah, I mean, I actually think it's a little bit sad that he's still behind the times. I think it's telling that this publication, he printed a 1,600-word editorial in the Cuban national paper, the Granma, and it happened after Obama left. It could have been very problematic for the trip had it happened before. But Fidel was kept out of the picture and really allowed his younger brother Raul to take the helm. And I think that the U.S. government sees this as an indication that actually Raul is in charge. He's the one who let this whole evolution of improvement in relations happen.
Tim Geisner, do you intend to return to Cuba anytime soon?
Absolutely. The second I stepped foot on the tarmac in Havana, I was like, I need to come back. And so all these revelations are just really exciting. I hope to come back either as another student or just with my family. It's just, I want to go back.
We want to have you back too, Donna. I know you've got your next trip planned.
Right.
We would like to talk with you after you get back here later in the summer. And I want to, at that point, also we'll explore what opportunities there are for Michigan State University in Cuba, because that's all very interesting landscape as well.
Yep.
We want to thank our guests. We've been talking about new opportunities in Cuba, including for students here at Michigan State. Donna Rich Kaplowitz is an assistant professor in the Residential College of Arts and Humanities at MSU. Tim Geisner is a freshman in the James Madison College here at the university. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up later on Current State, commentator Gary Wilson joins us to talk about March's biggest environmental stories. We'll be talking about what the recently released Flint Water Task Force report means for the future of the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, and we'll talk about a new $77 million project to cut down toxic algae in Lake Erie. That's on the way. Well, are you trying to decide what to plant in your yard this spring? Well, we did some digging and discovered a class being offered at Harris Nature Center tonight called Native Plants Make Gardening Easier. It's taught by Vern Stevens, the owner of Designs by Nature. And current state producer Katie Cook went out to Langsburg and spoke to Vern to learn more. Katie, tell us about what you saw.
I saw greenhouses full of seedlings, just trays and trays of little plugs of dirt. He collects these seeds from their natural habitats all over the state, and he documents them. He cultivates them in his greenhouses, and then he helps reintroduce them back into nature.
Did you learn anything interesting?
Yes. So Vern taught me that two seedlings of the same species grow on totally different cycles depending on where they're from. So he had two of the same species growing side by side in his greenhouse, but one seed had been taken from the UP and one seed was from Lansing. The one from the UP shot up like 3 inches while the other one, and the one from Lansing, was still barely sprouting because the one from the UP thought that it had to like hurry up and bloom because it was too cold.
Interesting. So you can take the seed out of the UP, basically.
Exactly. So Vern started by telling me about his 8-year-old son's passion for native plants and the very cool gardening project he helped with at his son's school.
So we put a butterfly garden in at the school. And third graders planted it, and it's gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous. They planted all of these kind of plugs, and they were all in pairs of two, in teams of two, and they would then plant the plug, and then they put the tag in, and then they would become the expert on the plant that they put in the ground. They would have to go to the internet, they'd have to research what the plant was, why it was the color it was, and then talk all about when it blooms, how long it blooms, and everything to the rest of the class. So, and that's an ongoing thing. And so then the kids are responsible for this butterfly garden. They're out there looking at so many monarch caterpillars that they've never, ever seen before. The girls are holding bumblebees in their hand and touching them because they found out that they can hold bumblebees as long as they're not aggressive with the bees won't sting them. And the girls are holding them in their hand and petting them. And I'm going, this is crazy.
Wow. It would be great if that could happen more in more schools.
Well, I know. We're creating all these little Aldo Leopolds. You know? And so that's the goal.
So the name of the class that you're teaching is Native Plants Make Gardening Easier.
Right.
How do they make things easier?
These are Michigan native perennials. So they belong in Michigan. They can deal with what Michigan throws at it. Whether we have our droughts during the summer or we have extremely cold temperatures or thaws during the winter and then it refreezes. They know and understand how to deal with all of that. They don't require fertilizer. They don't require special conditions. They don't require watering. So in the end, all of the maintenance that you have to do is minimal if you do the site prep and the installation properly. And so you're picking a plant that's supposed to be here. So it's going to do what it needs to do.
You talked about some other benefits in terms of wildlife. So what happens when you plant native plants? What kind of things do they attract?
They're going to attract the insects that feed on those plants. When I say insects, I'm talking caterpillars and some of the other insects that are important in the food chain. And so I didn't understand this until I started asking the question, how does a monarch find milkweed in an open field? Well, every plant puts out a pheromone. Those insects identify that pheromone, will then seek that plant out, find it, and then feed on it. And they recognize that. If they don't recognize that plant's pheromone, they won't feed on that plant.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I feel like everyone just, the common knowledge is, you know, flowers attract butterflies. But it's not every flower attracting every butterfly.
And it's not just a nectar source. Every plant has a nectar source, and the butterflies will use that. But for instance, the monarch, it seeks out milkweed in order to lay its eggs. And that's what the food source, the host species, is for that caterpillar. Without it, it's not going to make it. So the question I always ask, how many of you have milkweed growing in your backyards? And very few people do. I mean, it's starting to happen now, or more and more are planting milkweed. But if you don't, then they're not going to have the host for their caterpillars in order to move the population on.
So is it damaging to introduce plants that aren't native into your garden?
It can be. We're starting to find out recently that A lot of plants that are brought in to many of the nurseries that are grown in large greenhouses have the neonicotinoid pesticides on them. And that stuff doesn't go away. It's on shrubs, it's on trees, it's on the plants that you introduce. And so you're introducing that into your garden. A lot of customers now are asking, what pesticides do you use on your plants? And we don't. We don't use pesticides on these because we realize that this is going to end up either in someone's stomach in the end, an insect's going to chew on the leaf if it's favorable to them. And so we have to be careful of that, very careful of it.
I'm speaking with Vern Stevens, owner of Designs by Nature in Langsburg. He's the former grasslands and invasive species specialist for the state of Michigan. He'll be teaching a class at the Harris Nature Center on Tuesday night called Native Plants Make Gardening Easier. So Vern, what kind of things will you go over in this class?
We always cover site selection because around a house, you have different conditions. You have a north side, which is good for shade, loving plants, early morning sun, late afternoon sun. It's good for water features. East side of the house is good for early morning sunlight, and it doesn't get as hot. So you can put some more woodlands there, but you can start introducing flowers. South side, good for butterfly gardens and good for other gardens because it's full sun. And then west side, the same thing, only it's a little more intense sunlight. So we talk about site selection. We look at soils. We talk about soil types and then how to identify whether it has nutrients in it or not. And then we look at pH of the soil. Then we talk about plant selection, what would be best for something like that. And then we'll go into possibly rain gardening, how to incorporate a rain garden into that landscape, and then go on from there, specializing in butterfly gardening or specializing in hummingbird gardens or whatever else that they are interested in.
What is a rain garden? Is that a way to use rainwater to water your garden?
Right. So actually, we'll design a garden so that the water that comes off the roof of your house or off your driveway can be diverted into this rain garden, hold that water there, and we plant plants then in that site that are specific for the conditions that you have. So if it's clay soils and it's going to have moisture for a long presence of time, then we put plants in there that like a lot of moisture. If it's dry within a couple hours, then we can plant almost anything there. But then we design or talk about how to install a rain garden. And then they also become butterfly gardens too, or hummingbird gardens. So we kind of incorporate all of those little techniques into it. But we talk about how to figure out how much water comes off of your roof and how big to make the rain garden so that it doesn't blow out after the first rain.
Do you advise people too on landscaping? Because I know somebody like me usually approaches gardening with what I want it to look like, what colors I want to have, things like that. Do you talk about those kinds of things?
We can do that. In fact, we often give a catalog out that comes from Prairie Moon Nursery, which has a cultural guide in it. And most of the plants in there are plants that we have here in Michigan. But the importance of the cultural guide is it tells you what kind of soils it likes, what kind of moisture levels it'll take, and it talks about a range. Then sunlight conditions, the height that it grows to, the color it is, and then how long does it bloom. And so we can incorporate that cultural guide into an educational document that they can use as a source guide, as a reference. So in their idle time, they can sit down and they can actually design a garden just by looking at the information that's presented there.
So we're standing in a greenhouse surrounded by hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of seedlings. Tell me about some of these species and what you're doing with them.
This one here just happens to be roundleaf ragwort. It comes from this one came from the Empire area. So it's a dry, loving species. We have others that come from the Mayo area. And so they're also very dry, loving species, but it played with them to find out that they don't have to just grow on very dry soils. They can be moved inland just a little bit and become good plants for nectar sources. They're one of the first flowers to bloom when the monarchs return. So it's a good nectar source for them when they finally get back to Michigan. Takes a lot of abuse. We've chipped it out with a pickaxe out of dry compacted clay. and it still does fine.
Wow. What do the blooms look like when it blooms?
It's a small yellow flower, about the size of a dime. It's a cluster of yellow flowers that are on a stalk that comes up about 12 inches tall. And what's nice about this is after it flowers and it goes to seed, if you remove the seed stalk, then the leaves start spreading and filling in gaps in the garden. It's pretty cool. And it's got a nice decorative leaf on it, so it's a good ground cover species. When we look at other ones, when we plant a garden out, we want early spring to late fall blooms. That benefits the butterflies, it benefits the customer because they want to see color throughout the year. So we like to pick plants that offer good blooms for those seasons, but then we also want to introduce plants that have long bloom times. There's a few that we really do incorporate into the planting that generally will go in more conditions than not. Showy coneflowers is one that blooms from June until October. Harebell grows from June or flowers from June until October. Wild petunia blooms from June until October. So now here we've got some plants that have extended bloom times. Even prairie phlox. It's a little more sensitive. It likes drier soils. So it too will bloom from June until October. But what we're interested in doing is now establishing those as a base and then introducing some of the other special ones that give us bloom for 3 weeks, 4 weeks over here on this side of the garden, 3 to 4 weeks over on this side of the garden, and now we get spring through fall. We throw grasses in there as a complement because some of the critters need grasses, and it gives you structure above ground. It gives you the texture that you need in your garden to break up the monotony of just the plants, the flowers.
Well, thank you so much, Vern. I wish you the best of luck this year getting all this work done.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
I've been speaking with Vern Stevens of Designs by Nature. He's teaching a class tonight at the Harris Nature Center in Meridian Township at 7 p.m. For Current State, I'm Katie Cook.
And coming up on Current State, arts producer Jamie Paisley stops by to explain why the lead actress of the Riverwalk production Wait Until Dark has bruises on her shins. That and more after the break. Every Tuesday, Current State airs a piece of music that someone on her staff has just discovered. A month ago, a powerful yet melodic sound came pouring out of my car radio speakers, and within seconds I wanted to share it. The Range is the alias adopted by Brooklyn's James Hinton. He creates his tracks by culling material from YouTube artists from all over the world, then souping it up with his own ideas to create what one music writer calls vibrant electronic vignettes. His brand new collection of songs is called Potential, and this track grabbed me the second I heard it. It's called Florida. The music of The Range, the track, is Florida from his new CD, Potential. By the way, the YouTube musicians sampled by The Range are the subject of a soon-to-be-released film by documentarian Daniel Kaufman. The film is called Superimpose. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Government failure, intransigence, environmental injustice, all were at play in the Flint water crisis, according to the final report from the task force appointed by Governor Snyder to look into what led to the public health disaster there. The report lays much of the blame at the feet of the state's Department of Environmental Quality. It says the DEQ focused on technical and legal compliance, while ignoring mounting complaints from Flint residents about the quality of their tap water. So, what lies ahead for the state's top environmental regulator in the wake of the water crisis? Here to give us his take on that and other environmental stories, Great Lakes commentator Gary Wilson. Gary, welcome back.
Hey, Mark. Good morning. Good to be back with you again.
Let's start with this final report from the Flint Water Advisory Task Force. As I said, the task force said that while this was a government failure at every level, the MDEQ was the agency that was most responsible for it. Can you dive a little deeper into how the agency failed in Flint?
Sure, Mark. The main criticism remains that the agency's mode of operation was focused on technical compliance with the rules and regulations instead of protecting people, the citizens of Michigan who pay the salaries via their taxes. You know, agencies like this are designed to be risk-averse and focused on checking off a box that allows them to say that they followed the rules and thus avoiding criticism instead of looking at the outcome. And to oversimplify that just a bit, early on in this whole Flint issue, even before the lead issue had become known, you know, you had citizens of in Flint holding up, containers of brown and brackish water, you know, as early as a year or even more ago, and you know, people at the MDEQ and others saying, "Hey, we tested it and it's okay." So, I think that gets at the heart of the issue there.
The task force blamed the culture of the DEQ for a lot of the failures that led to the problems in Flint. How did the report describe that culture?
Well, as you said in your intro, it was a culture, and I'm quoting here, that was intransigent and belligerent. And this was even when they were confronted with their own failures. That's a pretty strong statement. It went on to say that this is the attitude that allowed Flint to happen, and that this had this type of attitude and behavior had no place in government. You know, this report has, I believe, 108 pages, so it takes some, it takes some serious reading. But there's no mincing of words here. Again, it said this type of attitude that was displayed by the MDEQ has no place in government.
The report didn't let the EPA off the hook either. It said that there was an equally troubling hands-off attitude at the federal level, correct?
That is correct. It said that EPA tolerated Michigan's intransigence and also that the EPA failed to exercise its authority to intervene when the intervention was clearly warranted. EPA knew that Michigan was failing, and it didn't exercise its authority under the Safe Drinking Water Act when that happens. And I think that's best evidenced, separate from the report, where Virginia Tech professor Mark Edwards, he's been the lead expert on this, he has repeatedly said, and he testified before Congress, that EPA was complicit in, and I'm quoting, aiding and abetting the MDEQ. And then just this morning, EPA whistleblower Miguel Del Toro was quoted in the Detroit News as having said that EPA, and I'm referring to EPA's Region 5 in Chicago, was, and again I'm quoting, a cesspool for officials who were reluctant to act on what he thought was a public health crisis. That's an EPA executive talking about his colleagues. So pretty strong stuff.
I want to return to an issue I discussed yesterday with Ari Adler, who's a chief spokesperson for the Snyder administration, and this involves environmental injustice, which the task force cited as one of the roots of the crisis. What did it point to as evidence from the crisis that happened, in at least in part, because it is a community with a large number of minority and low-income residents? What did it point to?
Well, it meets the classic definition of environmental justice injustice, and that is where people are treated differently on environmental issues based on their race and/or economic status. I think that was clearly evidenced in Flint, and perhaps it's best illustrated by an internal EPA email that was part of an EPA email dump a few weeks ago. Where an EPA staffer, again, in the Region 5 office in Chicago, said, I'm not so sure Flint is a community we want to go out on a limb for. Now, in context, that was relating to Flint's financial status, and it's subject to interpretation, but it seems to send the message that maybe there's some communities we'll take a risk for and take strong action, and maybe some are just not worth it. You can read into that what you want, but I think that there's a pretty strong signal there.
Gary Wilson is a Great Lakes environmental commentator. We're talking about the biggest environmental stories from around the region this month. Recent reporting by the Detroit Free Press's Keith Matheny found that Flint wasn't the only time that the culture at the MDEQ seemed to value technical compliance over complaints from residents. Can you talk to us about some of those other cases?
Sure, Mark. Matheny's report talked about the perception or the reality, depending on maybe your viewpoint, that the MDEQ under the Snyder administration has been more business-friendly than responsive to the needs of citizens. Again, that technical compliance emphasis. And in his article, he referred to Marathon Oil and the Petcoke issues, storage issues in Detroit, where MDEQ sided with the business interests over those of the public. In his report, Matheny cited the MDEQ's mission statement under Governor Snyder that says MDEQ should be full partners in Michigan's economic development. Now, mission statements are high level, but they're also designed to send messages about priorities. Read what you want into it, but I think the message had been sent at the highest levels of government in Michigan that business was supposed to have a prominent seat at the table when making environmental decisions.
There has been a personnel shift at the DEQ. Dan Wyant, the former chief, stepped down. Several other key figures in the department either resigned or were let go. But has Governor Snyder said anything about how he plans to implement a cultural shift? And will changing out the leadership of the agency be enough?
Well, I haven't seen anything from the governor, but in response to your question, will changing the leader at the agency be enough? I would say no. Rejiggering, putting a new leader in and rejiggering the boxes on an organizational chart won't cut it. Governor Snyder has personally and publicly blamed the MDEQ for Flint, and he's accepted accountability for their failures. He now has ownership of MDEQ, its mission, how it treats citizens, and the results it produces. So he's out of excuses, and he'll have to be accountable for what MDEQ does from here on. And you know, the whole world will be watching from this point.
Keith Cray is the interim director at DEQ right now. Do you have any feeling at all for how long? He is a longtime administrator, I think generally pretty widely respected. Do you have any feeling for how long Mr. Cray might remain at the top at DEQ?
I don't, and my cursory research, gives him high marks. He's a respected executive, but he's also on the inside of the Snyder administration and Michigan government, and to have credibility going forward, I'm wondering if the governor doesn't need to appoint somebody who is outside of his inner circle, so to speak, and can really lend some credence that the MDEQ will be acting with a new mission and acting responsibly and considering the citizens of Michigan over other matters.
We were hoping to have time to talk to you about Lake Erie, but that is going to have to wait for another visit. There have been reports and studies done involving phosphorus runoff into Lake Erie. I'm sorry we're out of time, but we do want to thank Gary Wilson, a Great Lakes commentator here for Current State. We've been talking about March's biggest environmental stories. Gary, thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Good to be with you.
This segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. For the next 2 weeks, the Riverwalk Theater brings the harrowing experiences of a blind New Yorker to life in the play Wait Until Dark by Frederick Knott. Current State's Jamie Paisley joins me now after speaking with some of the key players in this thriller. I remember the movie well.
Oh, yeah, and as does the cast, I would say. For this play, Wait Until Dark, yes, it's about a blind New Yorker grappling with the criminal element taking over their home. And even as I describe it, well, it may sound a bit similar to that basic plot of the Marvel comics and recent Netflix hit series Daredevil and its blind protagonist. But that's not even the only similarity. Daredevil, that superhero from Hell's Kitchen, New York City, was first released by Marvel Comics in 1964, and the first production of the Wait Until Dark play with its blind heroine, Susie Hendricks, hailing from Greenwich Village, New York City, also. That was first staged just 2 years later, in 1966, and soon after was turned into that suspenseful film with Audrey Hepburn. That said, I had to ask Rita Deibler, the director of this upcoming Wait Until Dark staging, about the Riverwalk marquee, since right out front the play is described as a, quote, mystery. When in all actuality, this is far more of a rare item for the stage, a theatrical thriller.
Yes, it is definitely more of a thriller. I mean, it's not really a whodunit. It's pretty straightforward. It's really just a matter of keeping you on the edge of your seats. You're kind of with our protagonist all the way and rooting for her and hoping she can put the pieces together. It's just a really fun thriller, suspenseful classic, in my opinion.
Now, the thriller aspect of this play, because as time has gone on, the use of stage mechanics as thriller vehicles, it's been shrinking because it's easier to get a shock scare out of people in the cinema. Yeah. Is that part of the appeal then that first brought you to this one? Because it is such, it's a rarity. It is an increasing rarity.
It really is. I grew up really loving Alfred Hitchcock. And I also loved Audrey Hepburn, and so I saw a bunch of her movies. Charade was one of my favorites. And I saw this kind of later, like in my teens, and I really, really liked, that she was a not just a strong female character, but we had to see her build into that independence. And I really just, the subtleties in this show are what I really enjoy, and having my backstage experience, designer experience, and there's so much that can be done with the technical aspect of the show that is almost its own character, and that's also something that's really exciting for me to work with.
And in the space that you have, not trying to give anything away because people should see it, but is it very much Wait Until Dark is my question, and I'm trying to be very circumspect in the way that I'm asking that.
Yeah, it's kind of a difficult thing to talk about without giving things away. But yes, darkness is, I mean, that it's in the title and it very much is part of the play. It's almost a character in a way.
So. Since Susie is.
Yeah, correct. She's blind and she spends her life in the dark. And so she uses that to her advantage at the end of the play. And it's a really great scene. It's a favorite.
How do you direct somebody into to play a blind person, because they're very much, especially with the way that this theater is set up, you're seeing pretty much everything that Cassie's doing with her decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't want to throw anything at her too early in the process. I wanted to make sure she was comfortable in the space, comfortable in her lines. But a few days ago, I actually asked her to go through the entire act with her eyes closed, because, you start to, even if you're trying not to see things, you get that vacant stare where you're not focusing on your surroundings. There's still that anticipation, you're still seeing those shapes, so you can't really have that nervousness, that uncomfortable in your space when you are in the dark. And closing her eyes was really helpful in that because it made her really uncomfortable. She was totally out of her element, even though she's very familiar with the set. So it was very helpful, I think.
I'm Cassie Little, and I'm playing Susie Hendricks.
How are your shins?
A little bruised, a little bumped. They get that way a little bit anyway, but a few extra bruises with my eyes closed, I would say. Yeah.
When you did the audition, obviously you knew that Susie Hendricks as a character was
of this condition.
Yeah, definitely something to consider, knowing going in how much of a challenge that was going to be as a part of the role, and being able to do justice to the role and to the show. So thinking about that and the work that would go in to prepare for the role, and as I read it, a little bit extra, I think.
And when it is come show night and the audience is full and people are around, are you nervous about looking into the audience and seeing people picking their nose and just trying to keep a straight face?
I am a little nervous about looking into the audience and not making those connections that we usually may as able to see. So I have been working a lot on not focusing on things, so I'm hoping it'll all just, you know, slide through my vision and I won't really notice things and won't focus in, I think, on those things off stage as well as on stage. It's a little bit of what I've employed throughout the whole show, thinking, even though I can see, you know, what are the things that anchor me to the stage and what anchors Susie in the room, you know, things that don't ever move, the table, the couch, the stairs, you know, things like that, that it's just always good to know where those few things are to bring you back into that reality and make you feel safe again. So I think regardless of, you know, the time of the show, that's something that really helps the character feel safe and feel in control.
This is a genre, a thriller as a play. Is it a shrinking number of those in the world?
Yeah, that's what drew me to it, is that you don't often get to go to a show that's live theater and a thriller and, you know, able to sit there and be in suspense and scared and all of those things. So that's what I loved about it. I've done comedy recently, a little bit of drama also, so a little bit of everything, but this is a first.
For this upcoming Riverwalk Theater production of Wait Until Dark, well, as if Cassie Little portraying the visually impaired protagonist Susie Hendricks wasn't enough, while the antagonist must master a few voices during the run of this thriller.
My name is Spencer Perrineau. I play Harry Rote Jr. and Sr.
And that's an interesting kind of pairing, though, those two different voices. When I talked with Rita, you did the audition, you had to do both kind of characters at the same time. Has that changed at all since your audition, or has she guided you in those two personalities?
Well, they've developed over the process, as they always do. And there's really three, and all of them, you know, like need to, develop their own life. This play's very functional, I guess, you know, so like, you know, like the way I think my character behaves, like the underlying character is, you know, like he orchestrates a lot of things, so everything he does has this, like, purpose, like everything is in means to an end, so like you have to figure out how each of these characters that he makes up are functional, like why he makes them that way so that he can achieve the results that he wants. Typically as an actor, you know, you'd work either, you know, by yourself or with the director to figure out like what their intentions are that even the character might not know about. Right. You know, but this character knows everything, that he's so intentional.
The Riverwalk Theater's Wait Until Dark with Cassie Little, Spencer Perrineau, and directed by Rita Deibler opens March 31st and runs for 2 weekends in downtown Lansing. Tickets and more information are available online at riverwalktheater.com. For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And that's our show for today. Coming up Wednesday on Current State, Kelvin Torbert was Michigan's Mr. Basketball back in 2001 before playing college ball here at Michigan State. With his playing days behind him, Torbert has launched a new endeavor as a children's book author. We talk with Kelvin Torbert and co-author Kellen Brandon about KT and the Radical Round Ball. Plus, on our weekly Neighbors in Action spotlight, we visit with Girls on the Run. This is a youth development program for girls from the 3rd through the 8th grade, and the core activity for all of them is running. Running as a means to teach important life skills. We will learn more. A quick reminder that WKAR's Spring Pledge Drive is quickly approaching. We'll be at that here in just a couple of weeks. We are looking for volunteers to help man the phones and provide other assistance. We encourage you to visit our website for more information. That's WKAR.org. We'll be busy with that beginning the week of April 11th. We hope you'll consider it. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Kevin Lavery directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, April Van Buren, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, and Drew Hill. Don't forget, we're a podcast as well. Take Current State to Go every morning. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. On social media, we're on Twitter at KAR Current State and on Facebook at Current State from WKAR. We hope to see you tomorrow. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's Current State on WKAR.